Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We're going to talk energy, for starters, with one of the country's best authorities on the subject, a man who has had long experience, among other places, with Mitsubishi Power in the energy arena. He's a practitioner, not just an analyst or commentator about energy developments. And we respect him greatly for all of that and always welcome the chance to visit with David Walsh. Dave, welcome back to Securing America. And thank you for the tremendous coverage that you're doing, notably on the program of our friend and colleague Steve Bannon's War Room program. I wanted to recap some of the things that you've been saying there for our audience as well. Specifically, kind of a sort of situation report, if you will, on the whole idea of the, well, Green New Deal, as it's been called by AOC and her marketeers. But really, the starting from the beginning of this administration, the takedown of our energy security is, I guess, what I'm interested in getting your current assessment of, and where it seems to be headed from here.
Well, the Green New Deal was embodied specifically and codified into legislation by the so-called Inflation Reduction Act of the Biden administration a few months ago that, unfortunately, some 14, 15 of our Republican senators voted for, along with a number of our Republican House members, leading to a majority vote passed, and becomes a centerpiece of the necessary spending cap to preserve the currency, preserve some semblance of fiscal responsibility, which again, a large number on a 4-to-1 basis of Republican legislators voted to abandon just last week. So, you know, the hands of the Republican Party and its leadership are very, very dirty with this. But what this plan has been about are funding, continuing the doubling down of incenting wind and solar, which are a couple of energy sources that respectively we've talked repeatedly about, are inoperative about 80% of the time if solar and about 63% of the time if wind are inoperative energy resources. And also heavily funding stuff like hydrogen conversion of the gas-fueled combined cycle fleet, which hasn't really been tested outside of the turbines itself. The infrastructure building to convert large-scale power plants to hydrogen would be a 30 to 50-year thing at costs of probably $3.5 to $4 billion per power plant, and we have 550 of them that would need to be converted. Things that just make no economic sense. Oh, by the way, at 15% less thermal efficiency and enormous, enormous costs for ratepayers who buy electricity in this country. So these programs have been senseless, you know, of course, combined with the administration's zeal to curb and curtail oil and gas production in this country, which has led to making OPEC, the Russians and Chinese, all nominally all the stronger, where, you know, in past days, the announcement just in the last 5 years, the announcement by the Saudis of curtailing 1 million barrels of production could have easily been offset by an immediate response in the U.S. to take all actions to elevate production on government lands to the extent the government has some control over that. And no, instead, just last week, Friday, while this is going on, Deb Haaland happily announces a 10-mile added circumferential no drill, no mining, and no oil recovery or gas recovery around a very large portion of New Mexico that had the tribal property protection. Now we've extended, we're happily announcing, kind of de facto, we're joining OPEC's production restrictions as a country. Now, and you go, okay, why does this happen? Well, this government actually applauds oil and gas price hikes because it builds to their narrative that someday these renewables can actually be cost competitive. So they enjoy and like the fact of these price increases and curtailment of production by OPEC, which winds up causing price increases, which is the goal and objective of them. So they curiously like this.
I want to come back to the Saudi deal with you in a minute, but it sounds from what you've described, Dave, as though this fits the profile of what I call the wrecking operation that is the Biden administration's policy, broadly defined. I mean, domestic and foreign policies basically have all got two things in common. One, they're bad for America. And two, they seem to benefit the Chinese Communist Party. And that certainly, I think, is the case here, based on what you've just said. Not only are we moving heaven and earth to become more and more dependent upon less and less reliable sources of energy, but to make matters worse, the technologies involved are essentially all shipped to us from China. And that doesn't even get into this issue of the Chinese high voltage transformers in our electric grid, which is another source of dependency that is, well, simply insane in a time, particularly when a possible shooting war with China may be in the offing. When you describe this, I'm sure that there will be those who are champions of this strategy who would demur at the idea that this is meant to weaken our energy security. But I, by any measure, and you've mentioned several of them, I don't see how you can characterize it any other way. Do you?
No, it's so consistent across all of the administration getting involved through the EPA and the DOE in beginning to try to force buying practices. Electric stoves, the swap out of natural gas dryers, home water heaters, home heat pumps to electric equipment that will be made in China, Chinese-backed. The distribution transformer movement to change all of the distribution transformers to something with what's called an amorphous core steel, electric steel inside them. That, again, mandated by the DOE now and incented in the IRA, is all 85% of amorphous core transformers are made in the world in China. So here we are again. And we know the story of thin film PV, photovoltaic cells for solar, 85% of those are manufactured in China. Now, I know there's a small distribution center has been built in Florida to make it appear that there's some Florida content of what we're doing here, importing in the last 5 years, $4 billion worth of solar panels into this state by NextEra, mainly, secondarily Duke Energy. The battery storage itself for utility scale batteries, are 85% of the lithium or the processing of the base material in the batteries are in China. About 70% of the production and assembly of battery storage for utilities are made in China, as well, of course, as car batteries. The same metrics of dominance of that space in China, which, of course, we're pushing. Even rapid EV adoptions by all of the incentives inside of the IRA. So this is 100% consistent. Every single one of these initiatives on the administration, this nanny state stepping in and mandating, here's what you can purchase, American citizens, and here's what you can't purchase, are all Chinese supplied equipment and materials.
Yeah, and
it's incredible.
It is incredible. It is
not a coincidence. Not a coincidence. Right?
It is not a coincidence, comrade, as they say. Exactly right. And Dave, we're going to have to take a break here in a moment. When we come back, I want to get into more on this question of OPEC, what the Saudis are doing, what the implications of what they're doing are. Well, among other things, for the reserve status of the U.S. dollar. And whether that is now no longer just a possible problem, but it's very much in the throes of being toppled in favor of the Chinese yuan or something else. We'll talk about that and more with Dave Walsh on the other side of this very short break. Stay tuned. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. We got another rude awakening this week about the threat posed to us by the Chinese Communist Party. An Australian think tank revealed the CCP has a, quote, stunning lead, unquote, over the United States in the development of 37 out of 44 advanced technologies, many of which have direct military applications. Kiss goodbye to the qualitative edge our armed forces have long relied upon to offset larger numbers of military personnel and weaponry fielded by foreign adversaries. Farewell to peace through strength. Among those responsible for this ominous change in the correlation of forces is America's top venture capitalist, Sequoia's Neil Shen, who, we've just learned, works directly for the Chinese government in helping it finance and acquire our best technology. That must end. This is Frank Affney. Welcome back. One of our duty experts on energy security is in the house, I'm pleased to say. His name is Dave Walsh. He is a tremendously impressive and experienced energy professional, and we're always grateful for the chance to pick his brains, in particular in light of developments like one you mentioned in the previous segment, and I wanted to drill down a little bit further on it, Dave Walsh. That is this new relationship, building relationship, I guess is perhaps more accurate, between one of our most important partners over the decades in energy security, namely the Saudis, and our mortal enemy, the Chinese Communist Party. And in addition to what you said a moment ago about increasing our dependence upon Chinese supplies, a whole host of energy technologies, we have witnessed the Saudis reorienting their oil sales and the currency in which those sales are made in currencies other than the US dollar, the petrodollar, as it's been called. Give us a sense of what is the sort of context in which these things are taking place in the Middle East at the moment and their implications.
Well, I mean, truth be told, they're having a very hard time holding their OPEC alliance together, vis-a-vis the meetings over the weekend that were very contentious with their member states, who have acted out with major consumers, China, pursuant to Xi Jinping's initiation of reaching out his Belt and Road strategy to Iran specifically, announced by him only a couple of months ago, concluded a number of MOUs and deals with Iran and Iraq for a 25-year supply of oil at 30% below the Brent crude price benchmark in the world. So that was a stake in the heart of OPEC. Iran and Iraq, of course, are OPEC members. Russia, at the same time, has already displaced all of the lost oil sales to Western Europe vis-a-vis the boycott with 2.2 million barrels a day they've lost. Pick that up almost entirely, 2 million barrels a day, with IOC, the Indian Oil Corporation, once again at $45 to $49 a barrel, way, way below global pricing. And the Russians selling diesel into also Brazil, into the UAE, to the kingdom itself, selling diesel at low, low prices because they've lost their European market. The Saudis have had, and then China has done the same thing with Angola, the Congo, Nigeria, two other states in sub-Saharan Africa have been consistent suppliers of oil to China. China now has got tremendous indebtedness from these countries that it's tying a payment in their currency to them for oil, not in dollars any longer, but also holding them hostage on interest payment relief to the extent they have massive indebtedness to China to hold down prices in the mid-40s. So the Saudis have had an enormous struggle holding together. The first two production cuts have not met their goals whatsoever. So you've got a very difficult time, but showing how easy it is for the U.S. to have simply you know, gone full bore, full all out, all in energy production, oil and gas production, especially oil in this case, easily could have picked up, can pick up 1.5 million barrels a day to really end the crushing burden of this cartel, this illegal monopolistic cartel, which, you know, we know well, the neocon Republicans have conjoined with the Democrats over history to basically applaud their existence and not really fight them and have a progressive, you know, media here be basically promoting the storyboarding of how serious a thing this million barrel a day cut by the Saudis is, the third one in a row now. They're putting a narrative out that is in partly an effort to hold up the renewables binge because it is so non-competitive on an energy density basis and so expensive. It can only have a prayer of being defended. If oil is $120, $110 a barrel, then you can more defend the Green New Deal. You can more defend the IRA, more defend solar, wind, hydrogen, things that just cost a fortune, such as we're seeing with all the utilities building out solar and wind, basically driving electricity rates up 20-25%, as has happened here in the Southeast as well. Businesses aligned with liking to see high oil prices, basically to defend with the government this green policy. So it's a little bit complicated. It's very, very sad.
But it's very, very sinister as well, I think. Yeah, it's fair to say. Yeah. And I wanted to come back to something you touched on earlier, too. Deb Haaland. We've done a dossier on this gal at accountabilityinitiative.org. Our colleague Trevor Loudon, I think, was the author of it. She's a notorious communist. And she's in charge of a vast amount of the land of the United States inside the Department of Interior responsibility for public lands. And I doubt, but I'd be interested in your thoughts, Dave Walsh, as to whether this is the last of the efforts she will be making to simply take off the market or take out of possible production public lands, and whether that is likely to become a permanent arrangement, or do you think that is something that if we get a new administration, they can be easily reversed and we'll get back into the kind of energy production here that we obviously need for national security as well as other business competitive interests as well?
Well, we shouldn't be fooled. Her actions are not her own. They are tightly coordinated with the administration. She acts out in advance approval of Biden personally and his other officials and their basic cabal, which is really Obama holder and company in the background. She's not acting alone. This thing with the Chacao lands in New Mexico, so curious, because you're talking also, it's a kibosh against the extraction of minerals such as lithium from those same lands. For heaven's sake, this whole EV program we're talking about will take five times more lithium than the world produces now, and we need to be self-reliant on it. This also squashes that at the same time as oil and gas production on those same lands. But at the timing of it, it's very curious to be a signal, I think, once again to OPEC, hey, we're in on these production limitations. We're in. We want to see the price of oil and gas go through the roof so we can defend doing things that are totally opposed to the interest of American ratepayers and fuel buyers.
Yeah.
to drive up costs to defend this green movement.
Yeah, and we're in on the idea that the Chinese will have a corner on the lithium market as well, sell to us in batteries and so on.
Energy Secretary Chu under Obama, in Obama's first term, applauding gas prices at the pump when they got an excess of $4 in the early Biden administration, that this is the greatest thing to drive these prices through the roof so we can make a big shift to EVs and less driving and more efficiency. The Obama administration was applauding that. That's the essence of their side liking these higher prices and actually doing nothing but joining the production limitations, but under the guise of the environment. This is incredibly sad.
And as you pointed out, Dave Walsh, here and elsewhere, the idea that you're going to move all of these things from stoves to electric vehicles and so on onto a grid that is inadequate to the the meet the need today, let alone the future needs, and is going to get more, you know, profoundly inadequate as we put more and more of these renewables, so-called, into the mix. It's just scandalous. I've got less than 30 seconds. A quick answer on the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. Are we continuing to sell what we have in those stocks?
Yeah, there are. Biden has exercised his ability through congressional support from 2016 and 17 to sell down to the authorized levels by Congress. Again, here a bipartisan vote in 2016 and 17, allowing this to happen. He's exercised it. We're now down to the lowest level since, I think, now November of 1983 in the SPR.
And is he continuing to sell? From
he's continuing to nominally sell.
Not replenish it. Dave Walsh, this is so frustrating on so many different levels. We thank you for your insights. Come back to us with updates on this because we've got to get this reversed across the board. God bless you, my friend. We'll talk with you soon. Yoram Edinger is up next about the Middle East. Stay tuned.
To destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to our next guest. His name is Ambassador Yoram Edinger. He has served with distinction in the Foreign Service of his native Israel, including here in the United States, in the embassy in Washington, as a congressional liaison and counsel. He has also been a consul general in Houston, Texas. He is these days the author of the Edinger Report, which is an indispensable resource on Middle East developments. And we turn to him, as we frequently do, to get a sense of what is going on in the Middle East and its implications not only for his country, but also for ours. Mr. Ambassador, it's great to have you with us. Welcome back to Securing America.
Thank you very much.
I wanted to start by talking about Iran. This has been a problem of the first order, really, from the inception of the Islamic Republic 40 plus years ago. It has gotten materially worse over time as the Iranians have marched inexorably forward with a nuclear weapons program. Yesterday, we've been told they've unveiled a hypersonic missile capability. It's a little unclear what that means, especially as it might relate to this nuclear program of theirs. Give us your sense, sir, as to how all of this looks from Israel at the moment.
Well, the issue is not really limited to Israel. It transcends Israel. It has to do with every single pro-American Arab regime in the Middle East. And in fact, it has to do with the U.S. itself, U.S. national security, and not only in the Middle East, but from the Middle East all the way through Latin America. The Iranians have been for many years among the world leaders in the development of ballistic technologies, defense technologies. And in fact, ever since the Ayatollahs have taken over control of Iran, they have transformed Iran into an epicenter of proliferation of ballistic technologies and other military technologies beyond the Middle East, spreading it to many anti-American regimes. They have provided the drug cartels in Latin America, in Mexico, Colombia, Bolivia, Predator unmanned aerial vehicles. They have conducted ballistic tests, ballistic missile tests in Venezuela. And the recent issue of advancing more such technologies obviously is a threat to Israel, but primarily it's a threat to America. And I would say complement of American policy, because the billions of dollars which have been invested by the Ayatollahs in the development of such advanced ballistic technologies are mostly from Western coffers, from American coffers, which have to do with the 2015 JCPOA, the nuclear accord, and in fact, going back to the tailwind provided to the Ayatollahs when they rose to power in Iran back in February of 1979. As long as the US will stick to the diplomatic option towards Iran, deluding itself that financial bonanza to the Ayatollahs would induce the Ayatollahs to accept peaceful coexistence and abandon their 1400-year-old fanatic ideology, as long as such U.S. policy will prevail, the Ayatollahs will keep generating their own input into very destructive ballistic technologies, threatening stability of the Middle East and the world at large.
You've painted a very large tableau here, and it's absolutely indisputable that we have compounded this problem greatly, including by financing the Ayatollahs and legitimating them, and never more so, I would argue, than under this administration, though I think it's properly understood as really the third Obama-Biden term. And this began in a very, very serious and misguided way under the first of those terms, Barack Obama's pursuit of a nuclear deal. But given all of that, Mr. Ambassador, what is your current reading on the red lines that Israel has drawn about the nuclear capabilities of the Iranians, the threat that it represents, and the need to prevent it from metastasizing fully to having a usable nuclear weapon, which would almost certainly be deployed against Israel, maybe against us as well, as death to America as well as death to Israel has, of course, been the mantra of this regime.
By the way, the red lines are not only relevant when it comes to nuclear capabilities. The red lines, in my mind, have to do primarily with the Ayatollah's conventional capabilities, because those conventional capabilities have succeeded in destabilizing greatly the Middle East, in eroding U.S. posture of deterrence in Central America and in South America. And therefore, the assumption that it's only the nuclear capability of Iran which constitutes a threat to America's homeland security, national security, as well as the existence of America's Arab allies, such conventional wisdom or such worldview is erroneous. We have to realize that it's Iranians' conventional capabilities which constitutes clear and present danger to the U.S. and every single ally of the U.S. in the Middle East and beyond. As far as Israel's red lines, the assumption in Israel is that there is a very, very slight chance for the current administration in Washington to shift from diplomatic option towards Iran to regime change or military option. And therefore, the decision has been made in Israel to get ready for it, for our own steps to avert the wrath of two powerful Iran, conventionally and certainly a nuclear Iran. It may take a unilateral action by Israel, although obviously we prefer to do it jointly with the United States. At this stage, joint action with the US against Iran seems to be a very, very remote possibility, because the key architect of US national security and foreign policy at this stage, Secretary of State Tony Blinken, has been determined to stick to the diplomatic option, irrespective of the track record of the last 43 years, which has proven immensely that the diplomatic option has been the best reward to the Ayatollah's anti-US policy in the Middle East and throughout the globe.
No, you're absolutely right. The idea that we're in the hands of Tony Blinken on this matter, let alone anything else, is shocking. I do want to pivot slightly. We were talking earlier in the program with David Walsh about the Saudis and their energy plays. I'd like to ask you about what you are seeing in terms of, speaking of Tony Blinken, his efforts to try to conjure up, if you will, a deal between Israel and Saudi Arabia, but exact all kinds of costs from the Israelis, including, I think, foregoing dealing with the Iranian threat and also, you know, lifting up the Palestinians to new exalted status. It's hard to overstate the mistaken character of so much of what this administration is doing, but talk a little bit about whether Israel and the Saudis are capable of having some kind of relationship without the U.S. meddling, let alone meddling on these kinds of terms.
Well, the fact has been that the U.S., that Israel-Saudi relations, mostly defense or military, as well as commercial, has expanded dramatically in recent years, notwithstanding Saudi pro-Palestinian talk, and notwithstanding sometimes tough, rough Saudi criticism of Israel. The reality, by the way, is that the Saudi education curriculum has gone through some substantial changes, eliminating not all, but much of the anti-Jewish, anti-Israel content.
Not
as much as the United Arab Emirates, but getting closer there. Mm. Obviously, the Saudis consider their ties with the U.S. the paramount consideration. But the current dialogue between Secretary Blinken and Crown Prince MBS of Saudi Arabia, in my mind, is a classic case of the gap between Western conventional wisdom on the one hand and Middle East reality on the other hand. In my mind, there's no chance of...
We have to leave it at that, Mr. Ambassador. We're hard out of time. I appreciate your insights. Thank you for joining us. Come back to us again soon with updates. God bless you.
Thank you.
Be right back with more right after this. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. We got another rude awakening this week about the threat posed to us by the Chinese Communist Party. An Australian think tank revealed the CCP has a, quote, stunning lead, unquote, over the United States in the development of 37 out of 44 advanced technologies, many of which have direct military applications. Kiss goodbye to the qualitative edge our armed forces have long relied upon to offset larger numbers of military personnel and weaponry fielded by foreign adversaries. Farewell to peace through strength. Among those responsible for this ominous change in the correlation of forces is America's top venture capitalist, Sequoia's Neil Shen, who, we've just learned, works directly for the Chinese government in helping it finance and acquire our best technology. That must end. This is Frank Affney. We're back, and it's always a delight to be able to say we're joined by Elaine Donnelly, the founder and driving force behind a marvelous organization, the Center for Military Readiness. You can follow her work there at cmrlink.org. She has for decades been a leader in the fight for, well, what she calls, and I think rightly so, the culture of the United States military, something that most civilians don't have any appreciation of, and yet it is vital, especially to an all-volunteer force in terms of the good order and discipline and morale and, well, readiness of the force. Elaine, it's so good to have you with us, and thank you for all the work you have done over these many years to try to speak for those who really don't have a voice in our government because they are military and they conform to civilian control. And I want to talk with you in this first block a little bit about the nature of that civilian direction and leadership. But it's good to have you with us as always.
Thank you, Frank, and thank you for all the work that you do. This is Pride Month, month of June, and usually very bad things happen in the month of June, and the Pentagon seems to be obsessed with the idea of getting behind the idea of LGBT pride. Now, of course, it's the transgender movement and its subdivision, the drag queens, and they're going all out. And however, there's some good news, that some things that have happened in recent days that I want to share with you.
We're desperate for good news.
Yes. Well, you know all the fuss that occurred because of the Navy's choice of a drag queen to be their ambassador, digital ambassador for recruiting purposes, a sailor that we wrote about actually back in 2019. He did a drag queen performance on the carrier Ronald Reagan. And he's been out there being a drag queen ever since. But now he got the credential of the Navy to go out there and supposedly represent the Navy in seeking recruits. Well, it caused quite a firestorm. And members of Congress said, wait a minute, this is not appropriate. So on the House side, Matt Gaetz and Elise Stefanik went after the Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin, and they questioned these drag queen story hours, and General Milley was there as well, and he kind of, well, I've never heard of that before, and Secretary Austin said, we don't fund drag queen story hours or drag queen performances on military bases. Well, that's news. Matt Gaetz gave him a folder full of news about these events going on in various parts of the country.
Now, let me just interrupt you for 1 second. The story hour means these drag queens were not doing pole dancing. They were reading to children in schools on bases.
Yes, they've done both. And remember, the military schools on bases, the Department of Defense Education Activity schools, parents quite often don't have a choice, and they don't get to join a school board if they don't like what's going on. So when these events started to happen, and they've been proliferating, and it's not just June anymore, it's like year round, these pride celebrations. But here's the good news. Secretary Austin stopped one of these drag queen events that was supposed to occur at Nellis Air Force Base in Nevada. That was last week. It was supposed to be on June 1 and it was canceled. Then he went a step further. And he's issued a statement, there will be no more drag queen performances in the military. Now, this is remarkable. This is something that the Trump administration did not do. So good for Secretary Austin. It's one of the few times when I will say that, but he took a firm stand. So now there's another bit of good news. Diversity, equity, inclusion is the watch phrase. I wrote about an executive order that President Biden came out with in February. It's the most radical executive order we've ever seen, and it affects all branches of the government, not just the military. And it says there will be special treatment of underserved minorities. And there's a long list, and it excludes white males. Well, I won't go into all of that, but guess what? Senator Roger Wicker of Mississippi, who's the ranking member on the Senate, has just introduced a bill. This happened yesterday. It's called the Military Merit, Fairness, and Equality Act of 2023. It's quite simple. It's only 3 or 4 pages. It redefines equity to mean equality of treatment. It gives some findings about how the military has always been in the forefront of equal treatment. And it says merit and demonstrated performance will be the primary factor in deciding promotions and various kinds of things that are beneficial to people in the military. So again, this is something that a lot of people have been talking about. We have to do something about this diversity radicalism going on in the military. And there's some House efforts as well. Credit goes to Representative Michael Waltz. He has a bill called the Warrior Act. And in this bill, he covers various things that a panel that was put together by Heritage Foundation, they came out with a lot of recommendations having to do with wokeism in the military. Most of them are in this Warrior Act that Representative Waltz is sponsoring. And then we have, of course, Chip Roy. You can always count on Chip Roy. He wants a list of all these DEI offices in the Pentagon. There's talk of defunding them. You have to have a two-pronged approach. You have to use the power of the purse and the power of the Constitution to make policy for the military. And I'm seeing signs on both sides, the House and the Senate, where the members are beginning to move in that direction. Now, the NDAA process was delayed because of the debate about the budget issue. Now it's going to be starting in earnest in the next week or two. I'm not sure what the timetable is. And it's always a circus. It's very difficult to navigate. But
And it's also behind closed doors in the Senate.
It usually is. And yeah. Although you can talk to, and I have many times, people say, well, here's the problem. Our mission is to say what the problem is. And they come up with solutions that will be workable politically. I'm not a lobbyist. So how they do this is quite often not shared with me. But as I say, I'm starting to see signs that there are some positive efforts here. Not every one of them will pass.
Let me ask you about the politics of this. Yeah, because of course the Senate is in Democratic hands.
Right.
Dr. Wicker is a senior member on the Republican side, but he's still in the minority. In the House, of course, Mike Walsh and others have got, you know, the majority behind them, presumably. And yet, as you've chronicled so assiduously over the years, Republicans have not always been entirely reliable on these things, and Democrats have, to I think a very considerable degree, typically been fairly, you know, monolithically supportive of these various I really don't like the term woke because I think it obscures the fact that it's basically Marxist in character. Elaine, I beg your pardon. I've lost track of the time. We have to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more with Elaine Donnelly right after this. Welcome back. We have in the house virtually Kyle Scheidler of the Center for Security Policy, the director of its Homeland Security and Domestic Counterterrorism Programs. Kyle, you were laying out for us this rather bizarre situation in which a group called the Patriot Front seems to be essentially an op, as they say, the disinformation at best and at worst, something that is used to justify, well, it seems surveillance and arguably repression against an awful lot of actual patriotic Americans. What I would be particularly interested in is how the FBI's manipulation, penetration, and use of contractors, including in your article at The American Mind, Antifa itself, to work inside and conjure up a greater threat from this Patriot Front outfit. Talk us through whether that crosses, well, legal restrictions on domestic spying by the FBI.
So this is one of the things that I think is so interesting. So the FBI and the federal government in general is, of course, limited in what they can do in terms of dealing with informants, human sources, and so on. They have regulations, they have restrictions. All of those things are going to come out if they go to court in front of a jury, etc. So they're somewhat limited in what they can do with actual federal employees. But there is no limitation for them to accept information from anyone. So you have groups, either private contractors or groups like Antifa, who are funneling information into the federal government. They can take advantage of that information, even if that information was procured illicitly. The concerning thing about this is the Biden administration has explicitly said in their countering domestic terrorism strategy that they published early on in the administration, that they wanted to expand the ways that the federal government could take advantage of outside information and outside, essentially, contractors to gather information that they themselves were not entitled to gather. So this enables them to look in and essentially surveil groups that they have no criminal case on. Typically, law enforcement's not allowed to look at you unless they have a reason to open a case, right? But a private contractor can monitor groups on contract with the federal government essentially without a problem. So they are essentially skirting the laws about what they can and can't do by using private contractors and by using these fringe politically motivated actors like Antifa who feed them information on groups that they may otherwise not be permitted to surveil. And so that's the concern that I have. And the Biden administration is pretty much openly saying that this is how they want to proceed because they have all these annoying limitations in terms of what they're allowed to do. The other advantage this gives you, of course, is if your data is collected by private actors or it's provided to you by political organizations that you have no technical affiliation with, it allows you to go before Congress and say with a straight face that there were no informers in a group, that there were no human sources involved in an activity because it was all done essentially out of house.
This is wrong on so many different levels, Kyle. And I guess just to come back to where we started, you've written a book about the growing danger of Antifa in the United States. The idea that the FBI is actively collaborating with Antifa to conjure up a threat that is not serious, not growing, not maybe even real, from so-called white supremacists and conservatives who are characterized as domestic terrorists, is well, it's an affront. It's obviously an abuse of power, and it's arguably creating new vulnerabilities for us on the home front that is just, you know, it's, as I say, unconscionable, and it should be terminated, it seems to me, at the earliest moment. Kyle, speaking of things that are harmful to our country in terms of policies, I did want to ask you quickly about the border situation. I know you're following it closely. You've been working with local law enforcement and others around the country, contending with the consequences of Joe Biden's effective elimination of our southern border in particular. One of the things we focused on in an important Committee on the Present Danger China webinar last week is some of the health implications of the border going away, notably the prospect of a serious tuberculosis epidemic erupting in the near future, if it's not already underway. There's also talk about measles. There was a report yesterday I heard about the police stations in Chicago now being forced to put on their doors warning, do not enter or enter at your own risk, because there's a measles outbreak among people temporarily housed inside the police station. This sounds absolutely insane. And especially as we talked about earlier in the program, to the extent it might encourage the effort to have the World Health Organization insert itself into our public health policy practices and directives, is just unconscionable. Your thoughts in a minute.
Well, I mean, I think that what we are seeing is that when you invite the entire world to cross your border with absolutely no kind of legal process, you get all of the problems in the world. Whether that's health, the spreading of diseases that we don't have traditionally here in the United States, or that we thought we've eliminated here in the United States, whether it's terrorism, whether it's criminality and crime and drugs, open borders means you get everything in the world. And that's, you know, that's just the way it is. And that's what we're getting. And these are conditions that are being forced on local and state governments that do not have capacities to deal with these things. And the concern that that creates is, are they deliberately forcing these local and state governments to deal with these issues to sort of overwhelm them?
Which they're not equipped to do.
Which they're not equipped to do.
Kyle, thank you for your time. Come back to us soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same next time. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Go forth and multiply.